There's not a lot outside of that area.
Provo feels a little far off from Sandy for that to be able to work.
Well, I've done that drive. It's bad. But it's not undoable. Yeah, it's not undoable.
All right.
Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals. I'm your host, Eric Morgan.
And I'm Evan Davis.
Evan, what's your favorite national park?
You know, it's funny. Given the number of times we've been in, like, on long car rides together on road trips, I haven't been to that many national parks.
Well, they're really west-loaded.
I've never done Yellowstone. I've never done Yosemite.
And you grew up on the East Coast, so...
Yeah, I think maybe the only one is Acadia in Maine, where Mount Desert Island and Cadillac Mountain are.
I've been to Acadia. I think it's definitely the best national park on the East Coast.
It's incredible, yeah.
It's incredible. On the West Coast or west of the Mississippi, that's where you have the lion's share of them anyway. For me, I think my favorite is, and you'll see where I'm going with this, Zion in Utah.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, I have driven through Zion. In fact, just did it for the first time a few months ago, and it was extraordinary, without a doubt.
It's breathtaking. It's a completely breathtaking national park. Utah is loaded with national parks. And guess what, guys? This is our Utah episode.
Mm-hmm. We talked about them quite a bit last week. Not in flattering terms, but that was more of a broad overview of how the season has gone. It's not gone well. So today I think we're going to use the shellacking 1-0 that Courage delivered to them on Friday serves as a metonym for the entire season.
And I think a good reason to talk about Utah through this lens in particular is they've played North Carolina twice.
Yes.
And North Carolina is the source of their only victory, which came in week two at home and was, as I experienced it when I was watching it, a freak result.
Totally. So much so that North Carolina missed two penalties back-to-back in a matter of minutes and still lost the game.
Complete madness. Yeah. Utah scores on a set-piece corner, Delfava on the far post. It's a really beautiful cross from Paige Monahan. And on an Ali Centner bomb from outside the box.
I won't be repeating those arguments again.
And then Utah played... effectively parking a leaky bus and clearance, not trying to string much together, but it's because they had held the lead. Going into this game in North Carolina, they essentially attempted the same strategy, but without a lead.
Yeah.
And boy, was it a battering.
Let's paint the picture, because 1-0 does not do this game justice. XG, 2.4 to 0.3. Quality chances, which, as you know, we define as a shot with an XG value of 0.15 or higher, 8 to nothing. Total number of shots, 20 to 3. Touches in the box, 46 to 3. And just so you have a reference point, the league average for a team in a single game for touches in the box is 23. The Courage probably deserved more. They had some bad finishing luck. Casey Murphy did not have to break a sweat. She did not have to make a save because Utah did not register a shot on target.
Mm.
That's the kind of game that this was. And it is bizarre that North Carolina only walked away from it 1-0.
Haley Hopkins misses a 0.3 and then a 0.38 XG chance in the first 4 minutes of the game.
Yeah.
The fact that Utah is not down 1 or 2-0 in minute 5 itself is sort of shocking. And it didn't get a lot better from there.
No, not at all. I mean, mere minutes into the second half, Tyler Lucy gets to be the beneficiary of a counterattack that ends in 0.26 chance that Mandy Haught manages to save, who, like, it might look like had a good game, but it wasn't the greatest of games. I mean, she was under constant assault, but she didn't have to make the most massive of saves, except for maybe two times.
And frankly, she did make them.
She did make them.
In those
and
two
it
times.
And it is the only reason that the scoreline wasn't worse.
I mean, Lucy also has this 30th minute opening, the sequence, which I really felt like was the sequence that was most indicative of, A, what North Carolina was doing quite well. They would get a first phase, a second phase, a third phase sometimes. This sequence has three phases. It begins with a Sanchez shot from outside the box, which Haught spills to Tyler Lucy, who has this sort of very narrow angle goal mouth chance that she sort of slices across the... It's a shot pass, a shass, to no one. it sort of ends up getting recycled back through, and I believe ends in a shot outside the box from Brianna Pinto.
Yeah.
Which ends
there's
up
like
off
three,
target.
Maybe four shots in that sequence in total.
Yeah, there's a Sanchez, a Lucy, a Sanchez again, which is a 0.2 chance, and a Ed Pinto chance from outside the box.
You know, hot save is arguably the best save of the game on Lucy's shot, that is.
It's that 63rd minute chance that Lucy is there on the back post, and Haught, almost like a goalkeeper in hockey, just like skates across her goal mouth to make this weak side save. And at that point, we watch these kinds of games, and I think if you're not thinking about them or not going to do sort of an autopsy after the fact, you're watching this game and you're like, wow, Utah's really holding on by, you know, just a single fingernail on the edge of this cliff. But also, quite impressive. Isn't there some inevitability here? Won't the momentum shift? Won't the tides turn? Won't Utah's collective efforts and North Carolina's collective futility result in a tie that feels like a win for Utah and a tie that feels like a loss for North Carolina? And instead, frankly, it takes a really staggering touch from Brianna Pinto on a cross from Ashley Sanchez behind her to play into the path of Kaylee Kurtz for this little dinked 4-yard chance.
I believe it was Kim McCauley who tweeted, "Your number 8 doing some really extra expert hold-up striker play after your number 10 is crossing like a winger to your center back who is finishing smoothly with her right foot. Totally normal stuff."
Yeah. You only find players in those kinds of positions if the game is so tilted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're so unafraid, if you're so chasing the result, which is what North Carolina was doing, just pouring on additional opportunity on additional opportunity on additional opportunity.
So I'm looking at their passing network, which essentially can give you a good sense of what their formation was like in possession. And they played a back three, more or less, using Feli Rauch pulled inside and being the main passing channel on the left. But like those three players who were operating in basically central defense roles while they had the ball, they weren't in the defensive third ever. Like ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
For 90 minutes.
I mean, very, very rarely. While it was defensively shaped a four at the back, in attack, yeah, it's three at the back. And frankly, sometimes it looks like it's only two at the back because it's so stacked forward.
And they didn't have to be out of possession very often because they're the Courage and also they're playing the Royals. And so they end up with 62% of the ball on the day.
One nice little rub that existed between these two games, and one thing that I think Sean Niehaus probably does deserve some credit for, in that first game in Utah, North Carolina spent a fair amount of the time only attacking just down the right flank and then trying less often, 27 and 24% of the time, respectively, in terms of just the passing into the final third, attempting to penetrate the box from the middle and then from the left flank. In this game, we're looking at the Courage, who essentially understood, having probably watched back that tape, that Utah loves to bunch in the center of the park, and essentially committed all of their in-box passing and then distributed it evenly from both the left flank, 47%, and from the right flank, 44%. Mm-hmm. Almost nothing in this game came through the middle in terms of entry into the final third or entry passes into the box.
Yeah, and that bore out. I mean, Ashley Sanchez and Ryan Williams basically kind of had their run of the place on the right flank. And then Monica Matsukubo, who I think is getting better and better by the week, is, you know, was the field general on the left side. And
by the way, I think it's Manaka.
It is. Well, right. You're right. It's Manaka. It's not quite Manaka. Yeah. It's Manaka. But yes, I've been saying it wrong. That's an own goal on me. But she, I mean, the ways it didn't matter. I was actually looking at the shot chart. Like every single one of the Courage's goals come between the two posts of the goal. It's that central column in the box where they took basically all of their shots.
For a second, I was like, yeah, Evan, that's where the goal is. Mm-hmm. And they do need it. The ball has to go. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you were to draw an invisible line all the way out to the center of the park from the two goal posts, no shots come from tighter angles than that. Or no goals for North Carolina come from tighter angles than that.
Certainly no goals and not really that many shots either. And those shots that did maybe like go outside of that window by, you know, a couple of yards, not egregiously so. So even though Utah was trying to clog the central channel outside of the box, they were completely ineffective at stopping entries into the central area of the box itself. And that's when you have problems, because that's where all the best chances are created.
I felt like Sean Nahas subtly adjusted the focus of attack and found more effective ways into the box. And then at that point, Utah essentially is so bunched. I mean, so many of these shots are deflected.
Yeah.
Once the ball is in these prime positions, you hope to have six defenders roughly in that area to create a pachinko effect of just like sometimes shooting the ball out of bounds for corners.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so, when we talk about last ditch defending, it is so last ditch at that point. And it, again, it almost works. And that's just the nature of this sport. There are plenty of games where, despite this overwhelming 3+ XG, you know, generated by North Carolina, where sometimes you just don't score and it's unfortunate. And then there are games where this could have been 6-0. And instead, we've ended up with Utah basically playing with fire, doing a thing that has limited hope of turning a result. And I guess the question is sort of why from the jump? And again, Utah, if Hannah Betfort, oh, poor Hannah Betfort, if Hannah Betfort is more fortunate with her 83rd and her 90th, 90 plus one chance that she has, they absolutely could have stolen a result in North Carolina here. But Utah set themselves up, I think, foolhardily for this to be the applied strategy of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we're going to take on 2+, 3+ XG. Because I don't think they're thinking about it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
Take me, if you can, into Amy Rodriguez's head. What are you thinking about, first off, before the game, in how you're setting your team up? And second off, once you're at halftime, and you've seen what that first half looks like, but you've still got a 0-0.
For Rodriguez, before the game, the objective is to just try and... you just have to try and slow them down. They're not a very fast team in terms of like the speed at which they like progress the ball up the field.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can find ways to cut off forward service, then all North Carolina can really do is recycle the ball. And that's when they look frustrating. You know, the moments when you have expressed frustration at the way that they play,
mm-hmm.
it looks like that. But if you are sitting as deep as Utah was,
mm-hmm.
and I should say the contrast between them, you know, the average distance from their own goal where the Courage would make an on-ball defensive action was the halfway line.
Yeah.
That's how high they were playing. And that's how high they could afford to play. You're going to give them time to think. You're going to give them time to find opportunities for overloads and then eventually try and like move the ball over to the weak side, which I thought Manaka did a great job of doing. If they tried to work the ball on the left, she always knew the angles to feed Sanchez on the other side of the field. And you get killed. And then I think at halftime, you maybe breathe a sigh of relief that you know, made it you made it through intact. But then I don't know what her solution could have been that would have been reasonable, because like the talent available to her is just so limited. So much of their attacking strategy has been like, get the ball to Allie Centner and let her try and make some magic.
Mm-hmm.
If you never have the ball and then you have a defense that you're facing who makes sure that like service is cut off to her or that she doesn't allow to progress into the final third very often, you're basically 80 to 90% of the way there. And those two chances at the end of the game from Betfort are entirely game state
mm-hmm.
driven, that they just had to throw bodies forward in order to try and snatch a result. So in terms of like any sort of tactical philosophy, I don't know if it really those chances really emerge from that. But yeah, I don't know. Like Ryan Williams and Narumi Mira just did such a really good job of trying to keep Centner quiet for the time that she was on the pitch that she didn't really do much. And once she is not doing much, especially if you keep Betfort starting the game on the bench and tasking Monahan with pulling pretty deeply inside, whereas normally like she specializes as a winger, like she was operating at times like next to Agnes Nyberg in central midfield. And that's, you know, That is a strategy because you're trying to clog the central channel, so you want to put a spare player there. But in so doing, you do not free Monahan to try and dribble the ball and potentially take somebody on 1v1 on the left or the right flank. So you're just kind of slowly cutting off every possible option to create chances. This is just sort of what this team is. It's, you know, you mentioned before we started talking, like, they're a full year younger on average mm-hmm. than any other team in the league, which we knew was going to be the case when the season started. But they are just not able to get any juice out of anybody in possession. And then the only player who really seems to be offering value out of possession is Kate Dilfava, which comes entirely from her having to, like, close down and recover, you know, space on in transitions and clear the ball out of desperation, which, you know, that has value. It yep. means that maybe you're not going to get blown out very often, but she can't do it all by herself.
You know, if we were playing by Major League Baseball rules and had to select one representative from each team to make an all-star team, the highlights would suggest you'd pick Allie Sentner. The numbers would right. suggest you pick Kate Dilfava.
Right.
It probably is getting understated because of how leaky Utah has been, how much Kate Dilfava is doing in comparison to her teammate in terms of, like, creating essentially positive action on the field. She's having a good season on a bad team.
And those things are absolutely linked based on the kind of production that she is getting because, you know, defenders with a modicum of technical ability have to rack up tons and tons of on-ball defensive stats mm-hmm. when they are playing on a bad team because bad teams are getting shelled all the time. And it's interesting that a lot of that on-ball defensive value is coming from clearances. It's not from being able to, like, engage in duels with players and either push them back or win the ball off of them and try and create a transition the other way. It's not coming from intercepting passes or blocking shots. It's all coming from, like, turning on your recovery speed, closing down somebody in transition, and then just hoofing the ball away. There is a skill to that because clearing the ball means you're getting it further away from your own goal, and it does it very, very quickly because you're just hoofing it. But that doesn't mean that you're able to generate anything beyond that. It's a frustrating position to be in.
To sort of just return to the Allie Sentner point, to give North Carolina some credit here, this was her second lowest touch total of the season. Mm. She's played 90 minutes in all but one match. She only had 30 touches. She had only 25 against the Pride. Checks out. This was her tied lowest shot total this season. She only had one shot. It was not on target. That is the difference between the last game against the Courage. So the Courage have made a real concerted effort to limit her ability to play, and I thought did a yet more effective job of doing that Friday.
Yeah, only three touches in the box, which is about in line with her season average, but it's still a touch below what you want out of a winger. The amount to which she's being relied upon in her rookie year very early is reminding me of sort of how things are shaping up with Caitlin Clark with the Indiana Fever.
Not wrong.
Clark, her talent speaks for itself, but she's still a rookie in a very, very competitive, very, very physical WNBA, and she's played for three games, and I think people have this idea that she's going to run over everyone. And I think the Fever also have that idea too, because they're not putting the ball in a lot of other people's hands, except for her. And that's just a lot to ask of a rookie with ton of upside. You know, anything that I've said negatively about Sentner does not reflect on the fact that she still has a very high ceiling and is probably going to figure it out at some point. But she doesn't have a lot of help around her in order to do that. And I think that's the thing that really frustrates.
Yeah, it's not bad player on bad team. It's promising player in unfavorable circumstances.
Yeah.
The Utah Royals that we are seeing here, despite Kieran's, you know, wobble, are the team mm-hmm. we thought we would see, are the team that the numbers indicated we would see. And I think if there wasn't a disconnect between what Amy Rodriguez was saying before the season and what the team's own expectations, as best as reported, existed, and these results, we would say this is just an expansion team that is figuring it out and taking a handful of interesting players and seeing what they can do with more minutes. I think, you know, your interpretation of these players' profiles depends on how interesting you think they are. But I think you could have looked at Hannah Bedford and Paige Monahan and said, these are really potentially interesting pieces.
If Ifeoma Onumonu as well before she got hurt.
Exactly. It's like the disconnect here is that what this team's ambition and stated ambition was makes me really concerned because they seem and totally unable to execute any sort of coherent style of play. It's exacerbated against a team like the Courage who are set up to beat them quite well, but it's been kind of just the case all season long.
It's interesting you talk about you can't see a coherent style of play because Blair Newman, who's a friend of the pod, he's a tactical analyst, and he made a joke once that like I understand despite the quality on display what Utah is trying to do. And his contrast was like, when I watch Houston, I have no idea what the fuck they're trying to do. And I think if I want to parse that joke correctly, is that like you can see how Rodriguez is setting up because she knows she doesn't have necessarily the level of technical ability in her squad than other squads have available to them. So it's a very classic sort of flat 4-4-2. You know, they try and push out into a diamond when they have the ball. And they want their wingers to get wide and beat players on the dribble. And if there's a cross available, you shoot it. But if there isn't a cross available, then you try and penetrate the box with individual play. And the issue is that they just don't have the talent to keep that up. Like, I'm looking at, you know, their pass network in possession, and granted, this isn't necessarily showing sort of the shape of the team when they don't have the ball, but like, there is such a, even despite the intention of using Monahan as a spare player next to Nyberg and Federer in the center of the park to kind of clog that channel, there is still this massive gap where North Carolina could potentially like play some balls here. Mm-hmm. If they managed to win it fairly high up the field, which they did a lot against Utah. So, you know, you see the structure, it doesn't look like chaos. But at the same time, you know, say, for example, in contrast, like Orlando, where Orlando plays in a 4-4-2 out of possession, but there are no gaps, either between lines or between players vertically. They cover every single space in that mid block as is required based on where the ball is moving. Utah, I think, is attempting to do something like that, and they can't pull it off.
I think if Utah is playing more of a 4-1-4-1, with Ali Sentner.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. That I think is actually the crazy part. Like, why are you putting a single pivot in defensive midfield for a team like this?
Yeah, that's what I was sort of going to hammer down at, which is like, which leaves them a little exposed. It creates not these coherent banks of four that you see in Orlando. It creates this sort of non-functioning defensive shaped triangle. And then Ali Sentner is sort of on the left, elevating into what looks like a 4-4-2 in attack because she's so much further up the field. And then there are real connectivity issues getting her the ball. Like, if she's not receiving it relatively deep and then expected to essentially initiate the entire attack by dribbling, they don't have a plan to build up. I get where Blair's coming from here. I'm beginning to see Houston cohere more. And but like, I think when that joke was made, it was true. Houston just looked like a bunch of U8s playing bunch ball.
That was about 3 weeks ago. He made that comment. So yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But also like Houston's attempting this total overhaul, whereas Utah is building from scratch. And I'm just sort of frustrated that this is what the best iteration of scratch looks like for them.
Yeah. When you have a team kind of like exerting a lot of high pressure on you and you are this kind of at this level of quality, like good solution is to just have your center back boot it long and get your flair player, namely Sentner, latched on the long service. But I mean, Del Fava, for all of her defensive capabilities, she and Lauren Flynn, who has to step in for an injured Kaylee Real, do not have it. You know, they are not able to find easy completion targets for their long balls. And so when all of a sudden that's gone, well, what the fuck else are you going to do?
Week one, when there was literally no tape on the Utah Royals, the Chicago Red Stars got out XG'd. Utah lost, but Utah put up 2.2 XG, which was good and possessed the ball for 67% of the time. Since then, it has been a pretty ugly road forward. They have not hit 2 XG in any game. They've only crossed the 1 XG threshold twice in the last 9 games. This team is an expansion team, if we're being generous about it, but I think an expansion team that is really struggling to play with the talent on hand in a way that is at least optimizing for the players that they have.
I want to modify an earlier point just about long balls. I mean, Keitel Fava actually is completing 68% of her long balls, which is quite good for a center back.
That's very good.
Yeah, it's very, very good for a center back.
On this team?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, where are those long balls going to? They're going to Centner, which could potentially, you know, unlock a dribble. They're going to Monahan on the other wing when she's playing. And Monahan is having a rough season that's looking a lot more like her second half with Louisville than it did with her first half with Louisville last year. And Flynn isn't helping. Like, you know, 48% on long balls from Flynn. You can maybe use Amandine Henry as an option, but like you also want Amandine Henry to be someone who can play through the middle and maybe activate the wings through a diagonal. Like, Amandine Henry's secret sauce isn't just lumping it forward.
No. But I also think, and this is maybe my positive spin on it, to the point you made about Orlando, when Seb Hines took over, made very incremental progress that we did not acknowledge. And only now, a year into the Seb Hines era, are we seeing sort of really fully bearing fruit. Amy Rodriguez has a very young nucleus of players who have been thrown into the deep end of the pool, and she doesn't have enough life preservers, and she's just flinging them like frisbees at this point. But eventually, some of these players will distinguish themselves and show that they can swim. Ali Centner has already done that, and they had so many rookie draft picks. They had 7 picks in the first 30 or so.
Yeah.
Give it a little bit of time. If Utah is a better team in the second half of this season, it wouldn't surprise me as much as it would surprise me if they maintained this level of awful. This is a not good team right now.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for a bright spot, it is a very difficult thing to make that jump from the college game to the pro game, or to sort of establish oneself as a pro. And month 6 or 7 of this team should at least have borne enough fruit to tell you who will and won't work in this system, and like what will or won't be busts. I worry that they aren't taking a particularly analytical approach, but I also think that there are a lot of young players getting meaningful minutes at this point. I'd love to see more time given to Brecken Mozingo, but also I think Amy Rodriguez is doing a decent job both throwing into the deep end and protecting young players. There's been a nice amount of squad rotation beyond Centner and Delfava. Not a lot of people who are in that like 1,000-minute mark who are also quite young.
Yeah. Mozingo's passing well, you know, when she's able to. Like, she's finding good angles to try and like move the ball into the final third. It just doesn't happen very often. And you would, yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm not really sure like why you wouldn't use her more frequently. I mean, I guess the idea is that you want Paige Monahan on the right wing, but Monahan hasn't been very good this year. It's sort of like what Kieran was talking about with Angel City. Like, just start blooding your young players.
And we're entering the part of the season where you hope to start seeing that. That, to me, would represent more of a plan than I feel like I've seen so far. But if the plan initially was just to make sure that we're not overexposing these people or breaking their confidence, things that we can't know, if it turns out that Amy Rodriguez is slowly blooding young players effectively, that will be a good sign. If not, I think we'll start having real question marks about Amy Rodriguez as a manager. But right now, jury's out, because this team just is at a talent deficit in a league with a lot of parity, but kind of didn't do great recruitment necessarily to put an initial roster on the field.
Yeah.
I think we needed 10 games to see who this team was.
I think they did too.
Yeah, no, exactly. And right now, I squint and I'm not like without seeing some sort of plan here.
Yeah.
That said, you know, when Utah ends up facing these possession heavy teams that want to crush you like North Carolina, the strategy of just like parking the bus and hoping for the odd chance, it's not going to work out.
Again, you just have to be so organized and you have to be so disciplined when you don't have the ball in order to make sure that there are no passing lanes. And that just that wasn't the case on Friday night against North Carolina at all.
The emergence of a second outlet or weapon would do a ton for Utah. And if that's Mozingo coming in, and if Mozingo and Centner can represent at least splitting a defender's mind about where that outlet is going, that would be a huge step forward for them.
Yeah, the problem is that, you know, like Mozingo, when she can get on the ball and decide to pass, can look pretty sharp with her final ball. Same thing with Monahan. It's not like Monahan hasn't just like forgotten how to play football, you know.
No,
like
her
passing when they actually can get into the final third is just as sharp as it ever was. It's just like there is a level of decision making that ends up freezing up a lot of players and then leading to turnovers in bad areas. And that's the thing that you worry about. If Monahan can tighten up, if Mozingo can settle down, and if Rodriguez can actually like kind of drill this group into being just a little bit more disciplined. Like, I know she wants to like press and she wants to press high, but it very rarely works, you know? Like, you know, they're like middle of the pack in terms of passes per defensive action, which is an okay proxy for pressing, but then they're at the bottom of the list in terms of turnovers that they actually win in the attacking third. Like,
but it's because they're so rarely in the attacking third to even win turnovers.
I know. I know. Mm-hmm. To look at this group from 30,000 feet, I think the thing that we can maybe acknowledge organizationally is that they probably could spend more money than they did to build this group.
Mm-hmm.
And we've mentioned a few times on the show, and we're not the first people to have this idea, that like Ashley Hatch is a square peg in a round hole in Washington right now. She has deep roots in Utah. Why not? Why not just go figure out what it would take for Washington to trade her? And pay the money. You know, if you put them in the sort of like grand scheme of women's club football across the world, they are still an incredibly wealthy team, relatively speaking. And
yeah,
the salary cap is high. I don't think that they've come anywhere close to hitting it. You know, we don't know that for sure, but like, look at the players that they have. They're not on big money.
It would be incredibly disappointing to find out that they had maxed out their salary cap.
It would be bizarre.
That would be so concerning about their squad construction if they actually didn't have any financial wiggle room right now.
It would be really bizarre. And I have to wonder, like, you know, like Kelly Cousins doesn't have much of a history as a front office executive. You know, she coached Reading for 8 years, got them promoted, and then 8 years later got them relegated. And then she came over to Utah to take the sporting director gig. And same thing with Rodriguez. This is her first year as a head coach. Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's not just the players who are new to this whole thing. It's the entire organizational structure.
Totally.
On the women's side. And there's clearly a lot of learning to do and a lot of growing to do. And I think the best you can say is that Kelly Cousins and Amy Rodriguez have taken incompletes, but it's rough. And, you know, it's obvious, even though I'm annoyed that people want to credit Allie Centner with the skill of shooting from long range, but even that aside, like, it's so obvious that she's loaded with skill.
She's loaded with really talent. Good.
And she's 20 years old. Like, the ceiling's really high on her, and you got to figure out a way to activate that.
Yeah, I'm more positive about Allie Centner than you are, but it's because I see her as a product of the system she's in and, like, the trade.
Yeah, and I'm not even that negative about
it. No,
all
you're
I'm,
not
all
negative.
I'm negative about is that, like, all I'm negative about is, like, can she, like, help this team win right now? And the answer is probably no, but that I'm not sure anybody could help this team win right now, even if they traded for Ashley Hatch.
And, you know, if you're looking for a positive side for Ashley Hatch coming here, the one position they don't need to fill is left wing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They could use a number 9.
There is 0% chance if Ashley Hatch shows up, she's taking Allie Centner's position off the field.
Mm-hmm.
I think beyond Delphava and Centner, there probably aren't a lot of like hard names in Ink here.
If you pulled Henri and Nyberg down together and made a double pivot out of that, stuck Ashley Hatch at the top of the formation with, I mean, I don't know who you use as the number 10, but you figure out some combination of Centner, Mazingo, and Monahan on that band underneath her and like play a 4-2-3-1 that involves a lot of, you know, kicking long to try and get those forwards going. That's, you know, that's a decent launch and squish concept.
I think 4-2-3-1's the path forward as well, but where there's interchange between whoever's playing your traditional 10 and what Ali Centner could do. Mm-hmm. A really effective version of that would have a lot of interchanging and allowing Centner into prime positions in the field to also create problems from there.
And speaking of Ashley Hatch, the example that they should look toward is Washington.
Yeah, you're not wrong. So it's about to be real dark for Utah until about July. They play the Current. They play the Spirit, they play Bay, they play the Pride, they play the Thorns. That's
rough.
That is the top four teams in the league in five games.
And Bay.
And also Bay.
When Bay have a space in front of them, that attack can rip you apart. So even though they're bad at the back, Utah risks leaking multiple goals in that game.
Bay Utah is going to be a pretty fascinating watch. I do worry about the other four fixtures for Utah. I'm hoping that Utah fans can bear what could be an awful next month and change and see it through the lens of this team isn't getting demonstrably worse. It's just the talent that they're playing is better. It's going to be really hard to get results.
Your point is an excellent one. This is a team that needs to be building for the future and doing it in a smart way. And I don't know if I've been convinced of that from the brain trust based on how they built this squad right now, knowing the resources that they could have made available to them.
Yeah.
And that might be David Blitzer, dictating things as the owner. We don't know. But you look around the league, and I can't think of too many examples of teams who, even if they're not good, and even if they're organizationally kind of in a messy place, I can't think of any other teams in the league who aren't trying to spend to the cap. Can you?
All the teams that are sort of leading the league in points are showing ambition in that direction. I think I would have a question mark about Louisville, but they obviously have like a different philosophy about how they're going about recruitment.
I also think that they maybe they're not like getting over to like the $2 million line, but I think they're spending a lot of money and they're just spreading it around among a lot of players. That's my hunch.
I would hope so. Seattle obviously has some bloat in what they're spending, but until that sale is done, I don't see the same ambition there. That said, yeah, you're right, but I also think if you were ever going to have a time when you actually hadn't maxed out the amount you were spending, do it in this period that Utah has done it, as you're figuring out what pieces you want to build with.
Mm.
Now, if they go all summer without having spent money and acquiring talent, that will be disappointing. But I don't mind the incremental approach. It just isn't what they stated they were doing from the start.
Yeah.
If we're judging them by the judge not what I say, but what I do, I see sort of a plan. And if we go by the judge what I say and what I do, I see not a plan.
Yeah, I mean,
Utah's frugal.
I'll nuance some of Rodriguez and Cousins' preseason comments just to say that, like, I think they all acknowledge that it would be very, very difficult for them to compete as an expansion team. I think they were aware of that. And I think they both said quite clearly that they envisioned a much longer term, much longer road ahead in terms of how they want to like build this organization and evolve it. But they, you know, at the very least, Rodriguez also said, like, there is the possibility that we could fight for the playoffs. And she's like, I believe that we can do that. And that's just not realistic.
All right. So as we wrap this up, here's the weekly segment where I piss off some North Carolina fans.
I feel like we said some very nice things about North Carolina today.
No, I thought they were great. I think that they are really good at beating up on bad teams.
There you go.
Yeah, Evan, here's a little quiz. They have registered over 2xG in five games.
Okay.
Who do you think those five games were against?
Well, we've been talking a lot today about Utah, so I know two of them are Utah.
Mm-hmm.
One was the road game against Angel City.
Correct.
The home opener on opening day against Houston.
Correct. 3.2.
And the fifth one, was it...
I'll give you a clue. This team's pretty close to the bottom of the table.
Was it against Bay?
No, it was against Seattle.
Seattle.
They haven't played Bay yet.
That's right, they haven't, yeah.
In every other game...
Very tight.
They have not registered a single XG.
Yeah.
So against Gotham, 0.8. Against the Thorns, 0.4. Against the Pride, 0.6. Against Gotham again, 0.8. And against the current, 0.3 XG.
Yeah.
This says to me this is a team that is very mid-table, capable of beating up on teams in bad places right now. And despite what the results are suggesting, really struggling to play against the upper end of this league.
Mm, yeah.
Like, and we're seeing it split like that.
And the results themselves aren't even like mind-blowing. Like they're on 15 points and they're in sixth. Like that's playoff worthy, but it's not anything special.
Yeah, I feel great about preseason picking them in sixth. It's where I think they are right now. It's where I think they will continue to roughly be.
Yeah. Speaking of summer transfer signings, would be very interested to see if they can bolster their attack in the summertime.
Yeah, and you were talking about teams trying to play toward the max of the salary cap. I have my questions about North Carolina and investment.
I think that they are top heavy, and that might be taking up a lot of their cap
totally.
Space. Like Sanchez, that's a big contract that they inherited. Denise O'Sullivan's on big money because she's the club legend and has been there forever and is also great. Beyond that, probably not too many people on a big contract, but they still had to go out and spend a decent amount to get Feli Rauch. They had to spend a decent amount to get Naromi Miura a couple years ago. Tyler Lucy is going to require a fair amount of money to keep her around. And she's actually been pretty good this year, honestly.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
Yeah, I think that they probably are kind of like operating. Oh, and Casey Murphy, I'm sure, is on a big deal.
Yeah.
So I think that they are probably just operating like as a sort of top heavy system, like where maybe like they and Louisville are close in terms of their spend, but the distribution is different. Again, that's all speculation. I can't say one way or the other, but that would be my hunch.
What we're really asking, NWSL, is for salary transparency.
So
that so we
desperate
can,
for it.
It is the thing that MLS does that I admire.
And I'm so desperate for it because I want my friend Taylor Vincent's job at Spotrac to be easier.
Totally.
You know? God, she puts in the work. You know who else puts in the work? Expected own goals.
Oh, boy.
Never forget it. Please follow us, please rate us, please review us, rate us 5 stars if you are going to rate us at all. Follow us on all social channels at xowngoals, that's the letter X own goals. And if you think we have an own goal, please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. Another 2-episode week this week.
We hope.
Until you hear from us again, have a lovely week.